interested in is the origins of the demographic transition. So this big, what's now global transition from relatively high and stable mortality and fertility rates to low fertility and mortality rates via usually sustained population growth. And the demographic transition really starts in northwestern Europe in the second half of the 18th century. If I'd had time to get the Swedish data, what you'd see is from about 1750 in Sweden, a secular rise in life expectancy, a continuous rise in life expectancy from about 1750. In the English case, that doesn't happen because although mortality improves from around 1750, the very high rates of urbanisation in the 19th century actually obscure improvements in this period. Because people are moving into higher mortality environments, which even though they're improving, are worse than the places people are moving from. but so if you look at English life expectancy in the long run, starting in the 16th century, you see a worsening of life expectancy, an increase in mortality in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. And then what looks like quite a modest improvement from around 1750. In fact, it looks as if, in fact, life expectancy is only regaining the levels that it had been at in the late 16th century. But in fact, this apparently very modest change obscures really quite profound changes in the structure of mortality. So the first change, which I haven't given you a slide of, is that there's a really substantial reduction in the volatility of mortality. So you go from having very large crisis mortality events, usually associated with epidemics, but occasionally also subsistence crises. And the amplitude of those crises diminishes, but the frequency increases. So epidemics become more frequent, but less lethal. And the second thing that changes is there's a big change in the age structure of mortality. So this shows the probability of dying at these particular age groups. And from, in fact, the late 17th century, adult mortality actually declines. So things get better from adults in a period when, in fact, life expectancy as a whole is getting worse. And the reason life expectancy is getting worse is because as things improve for adults, they actually get worse for children. And if you look at what's going on within these ages under 15, there's this worsening of mortality in the late 17th and early 18th century, particularly in young children, and then improvements at older ages. And most of the improvement for infants, children in the first year of age, is actually in the first month. Things remain very bad for older infants and get better in the first month. So what the most plausible explanation of these patterns, this reduction in volatility and this change in the age structure, is that as England and indeed the other countries in this sort of North Sea basin area become more economically integrated, they also become more epidemiologically integrated. So epidemic diseases come more frequently, they circulate more frequently through the population. And therefore, for diseases which are immunising, that confer long-lasting immunity, if they come infrequently, then most of the population will be susceptible. So you get these very large mortality spikes, adults as well as children are affected. But as these diseases circulate more frequently, most adults would have already been exposed to these diseases in childhood, so their mortality risk declines, but children are exposed more frequently to these diseases and they become diseases of childhood. So in fact, overall mortality rises, but it affects different age groups differently. Mortality becomes concentrated in childhood. Interestingly, things improve for infants more than for older children, purely because there's this improvement in the first month of life that is probably connected with improvements in maternal health. So as the health of mothers improves, so does the health of neonates. The third change, though, that occurs that doesn't fit so well with this endemicization or epidemiological integration hypothesis is what happens in urban populations. Because you might expect, as diseases are circulating more frequently, that urban populations would be worst affected. And indeed, in urban populations, and this is John Land's work from London Quakers, this is showing infant mortality, so mortality in the first year of life. You can see in this period after between 1650 and 1750. This is the rise in infant mortality in the English population, represented by sample parishes. And this is what happens amongst London Quakers. So this is the same pattern, but massively amplified. So in the worst period, perhaps 350 per 1,000 infants die in the first year of life. So over a third of infants are dying in the first year of life. And so in this period, cities and even quite small towns are quite lethal. And this is really the period where cities are demographic sinks. They're unable to grow by natural increase, and they actually require a constant flow of in-migration to just sustain the population, let alone to grow. And London in this period is the largest city in Europe, with perhaps 750,000 people. So probably the worst case scenario. But what's really striking is that the improvement in, at least amongst the London Quakers, is really dramatic. And it's hard to understand how, if diseases are becoming more frequent and concentrated in childhood, why you would get large improvements in cities. That's the last place you would expect to see such improvements. To the extent that, indeed, London as a whole, once we get from, this is the parish register period that I'll explain in a minute, when we get to civil registration, London has similar infant mortality rates to the country as a whole. So that's quite an achievement for such a large and densely populated city. Ah, that's the problem. That's right. Well, that's the question. Are the Quakers actually representative? It turns out they are. So, amongst the national sample, which was created by the Cambridge Group for the History of Population and Social Structure, and is comprised of 26 parishes, which are mainly rural and small towns, so don't represent what's going on in big cities. This is showing the probability of dying by days of age in infancy and in the second year of life, so 1 year olds. And this is the first month of life, and you can see in the mid 18th century, 80 per 1,000 children born are dying in the first month of life, and then there's this progressive improvement over the period, and that's really the only improvement that you're getting in the first 2 years of life. There's a very modest improvement later in the first year of life, but it's very small. Whereas if you look at London Quakers, John Landis' sample, there's improvement both in the first month of life, green means good, getting better, but also quite a large improvement for older infants. And the reason that we usually use this division of neonatal mortality and post-neonatal mortality is that, in general, neonatal mortality is dominated by what are called endogenous causes of death. So causes of death associated with in utero conditions, genetic abnormalities, prematurity, accidents in birth. Later in infancy, and certainly in the second year of life, infectious diseases come to dominate mortality. In historical populations. So the puzzle is, why in London does infectious disease mortality appear to reduce in these young children, and why does it happen so early? So I've just shown you all these age-specific rates as if they're very common to come across, but in the English population it's very difficult to work out what's going on at all, because we don't have population censuses in general. They give even the number of people in the population, let alone the number of people in different age groups. What we usually have is not births or deaths, but baptisms of infants and burials. And the burials don't usually give age or cause of death. So you have a whole lot of burials, and you can divide them by the number of baptisms or some guess about the size of the population to get a crude mortality rate, but you can't work out the rates of mortality in infancy and second year of life, etc. And to address this problem, the French demographer Henri developed the technique of family reconstitution, which has been actually applied most successfully to the English population, where you define rules of observation where you can determine that people are actually in your sample and at risk of dying. And then you can work out their ages. So how it usually works in a nice rural settlement with people with unusual names and not much migration is you find these people with nice unusual names. Usually they're called John and Elizabeth, but sometimes the parents have the wisdom to give them a useful name. You find a marriage of two people, and then hopefully they stay in the parish and you follow the baptisms of their children, the burials of their children if any of them die, and hopefully the parents die in the parish, and then you know, well, they have to die. Okay? So it's best that they die in the parish. And then you know that you've got the full reproductive history of that family. You can follow the children from their baptism, you know their age if they die, and because actually mobility was quite high in the English population, even in rural settlements, you have to throw them out at age 15 and because they're quite likely to have moved to work as agricultural servants, etc., unless you find them marrying in the parish, and then you can actually follow their family. So ideally then you know how many children of different ages you have in your sample, and you can work out the deaths at those ages and divide them by the number of children at those ages to get your age-specific mortality rates. Ideally, oh, they fell off. Ideally, or maybe they didn't. I don't have animation. There you go. Ideally, you get the baptisms of the parents as well, and then you can work out what age the parents married, and you can get age-specific fertility rates for the parents, and you can calculate adult mortality because you know the ages at which the parents die. So this is what you want, but you don't get that in cities because the death rates are so high that you do have migrants coming in all the time. Obviously, because of economic opportunities not to fill the biggest people die, but so you have very high in-migration, but also because cities are large, there's the problem that two individuals may have the same name, so you may not be able to distinguish them. But also that because cities are usually comprised of a number of parishes, and records come in units of parishes, because the records kept by the church, if someone moves a couple of streets, they may move out of the parish that you're studying. So they're still in the city, but they've effectively disappeared from observation, from the demographer's point of view. So in a city like London, what you'll get is lots of people with really boring names, and you'll find a couple of baptisms that look like they belong to the parents, and lots, you do get deaths, that's good. But you tend not to get very many baptisms because of the mobility of families and also because of high mortality. And so you might get, say, three baptisms, but you don't know if that was the end of the parents' reproductive history or they moved away. So in that case, you actually have to use the date of the last baptism as when you assume your family left, because you have no further events. And you can't actually use this child, you can't follow up that child, you can only follow up the children born before the last event you saw in the family. Also note that the baptisms aren't where I put the births, this is the child being born, because particularly in the 18th century, people waited a long time to baptise their children often, incredibly annoyingly, because obviously their children could die before they were baptised. But in London, people also baptised privately. Unfortunately, in the parish I work on, the parish part was sufficiently venal to record all these private baptisms, extra fees. So we have a lot of those private baptisms in our sample. But so it's very difficult to work on cities, and that's why John Landers used Quakers to study mortality in London, because Quakers recorded births and deaths instead of baptisms and burials, so you don't have this problem of children dying potentially before the baptism's recorded. Also, identity as a member of the Quaker chapter was important, so people tended to register their events quite scrupulously. The problems with the Quakers, of course, are they representative? They were relatively affluent. They might have had other practices, for instance, precocious adoption of smallpox inoculation, which I think they did. So they might differ from the national, from the London population more broadly. Now, the good things about cities are that, because they often created bills of mortality that reported burials by age and separately by cause, these things were often recorded in records. And so I've been working on the parish of St. Martin in the Fields, which is in Westminster, so the west end of London. It was a large parish, large physically, but also it had a population of about 25,000 people throughout the second half of the 18th century, which makes it bigger than all but the biggest English town, so quite interesting in its own right, but also about 5% of events in the London bills of mortality come from St. Martin in the Fields. This isn't a great map, because it doesn't show you that the river is here. It was quite an affluent parish, because the West End at this point was an area that elite families were moving into to get away from central London. It's got the Palace of St. James here. These are baptism fees that people paid, and it's just showing the spatial distribution of the rich. So these are the highest baptism fees found. And so you have rich people living along the main thoroughfares. But because it's such a large parish, both physically and in population size, it fulfills all the functions of a town, so it has a very diverse population. It had one of the largest workhouses in London, so for the residential care of the poor. and so you have a large number of paupers in the parish, and all sorts of different occupational groups. So it's, if you look at the occupational structure of the parish, it's actually quite representative of London as a whole. And the rich, so here's Adelphi Wharf down by the river. They live close to what was then a very insalubrious river, together with the poor. So although there's some spatial segregation, it's at the level of the street rather than larger units. this is giving an example of... So what's good about St. Martin in the Fields is that in addition to the normal registers you would get, baptism registers, burial registers, there are also fee books that have survived which record what people actually paid for things and actually recorded a lot more information than you would normally find in a baptism or burial register. So the burial fee books record how much was paid for burial, whether the burial was exported, which you wouldn't normally find. But if someone dies in the parish but wants to be buried somewhere else, they had to pay a fine. And that gets recorded. So you can follow people who are moving, because not only did people migrate in life, but they also migrated after death. So they would move to, they'd be buried in another parish, which would be very annoying. But a lot of it's actually recorded here. And we can also see people coming in. So it recorded their street address, so we can see if people who are being buried in St. Martin's actually came from another parish. It gives cause of death. That's not very useful in infancy, because they all die. But it's useful, for instance, with respect to smallpox. The baptism books also record the fee paid for baptism, and that gives us some indication of social status. This is just an example of a family with a good name. and we have their date of marriage. So we've linked marriages. We also have marriage fees paid, but we could only link marriages to about a quarter of the family. So we put the baptisms together into families on the basis of what the parents' names were and where they lived, but we can't always find the beginning of the family, the marriage. So we've got a mix of families, perhaps that we've caught at the beginning or at the end of their reproductive period or somewhere in the middle. So we don't know much about the age of the parents, etc., because very few of them, we wouldn't be able to find the baptisms because most of them would be born in St. Martin's. So this is an example. Fortunately, they're not all like this, but this is an example of a family that baptises their children at home. Now, this is a period in which the fees weren't highly differentiated. So we've got highly differentiated baptism fees between 1752 and 1794, where it gives you a very good indication of social status. From 1795, they either paid nothing, so they were paupers, or they paid a set fee. Because there was a clean-up of the sort of charging of ludicrous fees for strange services. So these people baptised at home, and they had two children who we can't find a baptism record for, we can only find a burial record for. So, but we think they belong to this family on the basis of their names and their address. So we add them to the family on the assumption that these people were a bit crap about baptising their children. So often waited more than a month to baptise their children. And fortunately, the baptism fee books record the date of birth, so we know how long people, how old children are when they're being baptised. So we add these children back in, we have their date of burial, and we know how old they were when they were buried, so we give them a date of birth and put them into the family. And then we have to chuck the whole family away when the last child is born. We can't include that one in the sample. So, using these data from St Martin's, these what we call partial reconstitutions, we've made measures of infant mortality in the first 2 years of life. We've gone up to the first 5 years of life, but it becomes less reliable because age of death becomes less reliable. So these are the first rates from the reconstitution in St Martin's, looking at neonatal mortality, post-neonatal infant mortality, and then mortality at age one. And these rates look quite low compared to even the national population of people living in relatively small villages and towns, let alone compared to London Quakers, particularly where infectious disease has become important in post-neonatal mortality and mortality in the second year of life, the rates look too low. And we've got other indications, which I won't show you, but various tests that indicate that we don't have enough deaths. So we need to do some adjusting to increase the mortality rates. And one way of doing this is to estimate how many deaths are missing using a technique that was also developed by Henri and used by Tony Wrigley and his colleagues at the Cambridge Group. And this shows data for that national sample of 26 parishes. So you look at the birth intervals between two successive births in a family. And so these are months between the births. So indeed some women were having a child 9 months after the previous birth. And the main determinant of the birth interval in the English population at this period is maternal breastfeeding. If the mother breastfed, then depending on the intensity of breastfeeding and the duration, this causes lactational amenorrhea. So she's not at risk of conceiving for some period while she's breastfeeding. So if the first child in this birth interval died, of course, she stopped breastfeeding, ovulation resumed, and so she's at risk of conceiving very shortly after the death of the child. So there are very short birth intervals in the case where the first infant died. Where they were able to show that the first infant survived the first year of life, either because it died after that or because it ends up marrying in the parish or whatever, and you look at the birth intervals, then the average interval was about 25 to 30 months, so quite an extended period of breastfeeding. It implies breastfeeding of about 18 months, depending on the model. Then if you look at the case where you don't know what happened to the first infant, you never see another record, you don't see the child marrying, you don't see them dying, so you don't know what happened to them. They could have died and you've missed the burial, or they could have left the parish, they could have survived. If you compare the distribution of birth intervals to the next birth after that child whose fate you don't know, that gives you an indication of whether the child's likely to have died young. Because if the birth interval is much shorter, probably it died and you've missed the burial. In the case of the English sample, the national sample, the intervals for children where you don't know the fate and children where you do are very similar. So it implies that these children who you can't follow up probably survived the first year of life. They probably didn't die young. If we look at St Martin in the Fields using the same techniques, and the sample's smaller here so it looks messier, you can see that these are children where the first infant died young. The interval to the next birth is very short, as you'd expect. And it actually implies, the shape of it implies that we're not missing many births. We've got reasonably complete inclusion of births in our sample, because otherwise you'd expect quite aberrantly long intervals just because we've missed intervening births. But when we look at those who survived the first year of life because they died sometime later, actually a lot of them had quite short birth intervals. So what this implies, because the infant survived, it was alive, but the mother wasn't feeding it. And that, so she went on to conceive quite quickly. And then if we look at the case where we don't know what happened to the infant, it's skewed towards shorter birth intervals than the case where we know the infant survived the first year of life. So this suggests that we're missing some children. We're missing their deaths, probably, because their mothers are conceiving faster than they would have if the infants had survived. Now, it could be that we're missing the deaths of those children, the early deaths, and that's why their mothers were more likely to go on to conceive quickly. Or it could be that these are infants who were sent out of the parish. So their family stays in the parish and goes on baptising children. So we think the family's in observation, but in fact, the children have gone. So they're not at risk of dying. They're also not in the parish, so the mother's not breastfeeding them, so she conceives quickly. And this is a painting from the late 18th century showing this posh mother visiting her child at nurse in the countryside. And the nurse's home is quite simple compared to the mother. And the child, there's lots of these pictures where the child's sort of clinging to the nurse and rejecting the mother because she doesn't know who she is. Because literally people did send their children for years to live in rural parishes. Now the question is to what extent this is still going on in the late 18th century, because Valerie Fields, who's done the most work on this, claims that after the mid-18th century this really dwindles away. Certainly elite families doing it. But parishes begin sending poor children to rural parishes. Of course, this painting is from this period. So we can either assume that all these children died and put them in as deaths in the sample, which would inflate the mortality rates, or we can take them out on the assumption that they're somewhere else, so we can't observe what's happening. And that's actually making the assumption that they probably experience similar mortality rates to the group as a whole, so we won't bias our sample. That's probably too strong an assumption, because the very short birth intervals implies they're not being breastfed by their mothers. They might be being breastfed by a wet nurse, we hope. But that usually had less positive consequences than maternal breastfeeding. So if we then adjust the sample, either assuming that all the kids who appear to be missing went to the countryside, or that they all died in London, then we get the similar pattern of mortality, but very different levels. So we get a change over time, reduction over time in neonatal mortality under both assumptions, and we get, in the last period, the first part of the 19th century, we get a reduction in infectious disease mortality as well. So the levels change, but the pattern doesn't. If we compare the adjusted data with London Quakers, it's better if you put all the kids in as dead, because that inflates the mortality levels to levels that you'd expect. Now, it's unlikely that they should all go in. It's quite difficult to work out how many you should die and how many you should send to the country. So this is sort of worst-case scenario. They all died. Half of them die in the neonatal period and half die in the post-neonatal period. That's just a first assumption. But what you see is that the London Quakers and St Martin in the Fields look similar in terms of falls in neonatal mortality, but you still have this early fall in infectious disease mortality amongst the London Quakers, and that fall occurs later in St Martin in the Fields. So the question is that real? And why does it happen later in St Martin in the Fields and it doesn't happen at all at the national level? You can also use birth intervals to infer the length of the breastfeeding period. And this shows, for the three periods that I've divided the data into, for the whole reconstitution sample, in the first period there's evidence of these are children who survived, so they're alive, but their mother wasn't feeding them and went on to conceive. Some proportion of the mothers weren't feeding and they went on to conceive quickly. So these are non-maternally breastfed children. And that almost bimodal distribution disappears and you end up getting a single peak. So it appears that the whole population, or the parish sample in our reconstitution, is moving towards extended breastfeeding. So the question is, how can we actually get at that? And one way to get at it is by using the social status information in the reconstitution, because there's a lot of evidence for differences in breastfeeding by social status. So in the English population in this period, breastfeeding was the norm, which it wasn't necessarily in other European populations. But wealthier women tended not to breastfeed, certainly in the 17th and early 18th centuries. And alternatives that they deployed, they were urged by medical literature for about 200 years, but it apparently had no impact. They preferred either wet nursing in a rural parish, which could also have the advantage of reducing infectious disease exposure, which was a consideration in sending children out of cities, or the wet nurse could live in the family home and feed the child, or the child could be hand-fed, so fed would not breastfed, and that was the most lethal alternative. And this is a picture from the very late 19th century, 1796, showing a fashionable mother going out for the evening and giving the child a quick breastfeed. The nurses brought the child for a quick breastfeed, and the mother looks deeply unimpressed. There's an argument that there was a major increase in maternal breastfeeding amongst wealthier women over the course of the 18th century, but it's mainly anecdotal evidence. So, so the sample for St. Martin's, we could divide into social status groups, and we chose four categories: paupers, people who paid the standard fee for baptism, people who paid extra to have a fashionable private baptism, and people who paid exorbitant amounts, but we don't know what for. And paupers and people who paid a lot each comprised about 10% of the sample. So these were the two largest groups. And when we compare, when we check whether baptism fees are actually a decent proxy for social status or wealth, we've got burial fees that correlate quite well, and also the rates that people paid, to parish rates, that were based on an assessment of the value of their property, of their residence. And paupers lived in residences that weren't rateable, so they don't actually appear in rate books when we try to link families to entries in rate books. You don't really come across the pauper families. But you can see that for the families that chose standard fees for baptism, they overlap, they pay the lowest rates on their properties, but they overlap substantially with these higher status groups. So the distributions overlap, although they're quite distinct distributions. To look at birth intervals, to look at breastfeeding amongst this population and to what extent deaths were being underreported, we divided the sample into two, the lower half and the upper half, because otherwise the two smaller groups were too small for me. Results. So amongst the poorer half, the paupers and those who always paid standard baptism fees, you can see that there's amongst those who, where the infant, we know the infant survived the first year of life, there's a clear sort of single peak at around 23 months. So these families in general breastfeed, and if you look at infants where we don't know what happened to them, because we have no death record, the distribution of intervals to the next birth is fairly similar to those where we know they survived the first year of life. So we don't seem to be missing many deaths in this group either. But amongst the richer group, and this is in the first period, the mid-18th century, there's a real overlap. For infants that would survive the first year of life, the birth intervals to the next birth are often as short as if they'd died. So they're not really being breastfed, or if they are, it's only for a very short period. So, as we expected, at least some higher status women aren't breastfeeding their children, but some of these children survive. If you look at those where we don't know if they survived or not, the distribution shifted more towards infants who we know died young. So it looks like we're missing a lot of infant deaths, or these are infants who are being sent out to the countryside. So about 30% of infants seem to be missing. So if we do the corrections again by social status, adjust the mortality rates by putting the deaths back or sending them to the country, so these two extreme variants, then when we look at, this is in the first period, the mid-18th century, when we look at neonatal mortality, if you scan across, this is going up the social scale, there's no social gradient. The rich don't have lower neonatal mortality rates or post-neonatal mortality rates than the poor. Indeed, if you add the deaths back, because there were so many missing amongst the rich, their mortality rates are actually higher than the poor, which you might expect if they're not breastfeeding their neonates. It would make sense. Or if you think they sent them to the countryside and they weren't too badly off there, then they certainly don't do any better than paupers, people who couldn't afford to pay for baptism. The only sign that the rich might have been better off is that this richest 10% appeared to have lower mortality in the second year of life. So it's possible they had lower infectious disease mortality in older children. Then if we look at change over time, so that was what was happening in the mid-18th century. If we then use the birth intervals to ask whether there was an increase in maternal breastfeeding in one of these groups, it appears that in both groups there's a shift from short birth intervals towards longer birth intervals, but the shift is more pronounced in the higher status groups in the last quarter of the 18th century. So it does appear that wealthier mothers are breastfeeding their children more. And you would think that would explain the reduction in neonatal mortality if more mothers are breastfeeding their children, at least in the first month of life. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work, because when you look at mortality in the first month of life over time, so this is comparing the middle of the 18th century with the last quarter, when we know there's a change in breastfeeding practices, there's within the individual social groups, there's no significant change in neonatal mortality rates. The reason that there's a change, if you look at the sample as a whole, is a compositional effect that in the second period, the last quarter of the 18th century, there are more people in this standard fee-paying, long breastfeeding group, and therefore that reduces the mortality in the overall sample. In the last period, the beginning of the 19th century, there is an improvement. At that point, we can only look at paupers and the rest, but there seems to be an improvement. But in this period, I haven't shown you the data, but there's no real change in the birth intervals, so they don't seem to be breastfeeding anymore. So it doesn't seem to be breastfeeding, although the story would otherwise fit. Another reason to think that probably it's not breastfeeding is if you look at the seasonality of neonatal mortality. So normally, neonatal mortality isn't very seasonal. The rates are fairly constant throughout the year because these endogenous causes are largely independent of season, whereas infectious diseases tend to be quite seasonal depending on the disease. Neonatal mortality in St. Martin's was quite seasonal. There was a summer peak, which is what you would expect if children were being hand-fed, because food's much more likely to be contaminated when it's hot, either by insect vectors or higher rates of pathogen growth. You see the same pattern amongst London Quakers in the first month of life. So it appears they're not even being breastfed necessarily in the first month. But what happens is, in this period when we seem to get a shift to higher rates of breastfeeding, the seasonality goes up, so summer becomes more dangerous. And John Landis suggested for Quakers, where he saw the same pattern, that the seasonality persisted despite falls in neonatal mortality, that perhaps mortality was becoming concentrated amongst those negligent families that didn't breastfeed. But it's very hard to get an increase in seasonality if the things that aren't seasonal stay the same and you get a reduction in non-breastfed mortality. Seasonality should go down. So this is quite hard to explain in terms of breastfeeding. So I can't explain that. I'm just telling you. when we look at post-neonatal mortality, mortality in the first year of life, so now in basically infectious disease mortality, this was where we saw that the richest might have an advantage, at least in the second year of life. When we look at the change over the second half of the 18th century between the middle and the last quarter, there's no overall improvement, and in fact it gets worse in some social groups, but paupers, but also perhaps higher status groups, so some general worsening perhaps of infectious disease mortality. And then in the early 19th century, large improvements in all groups. Now the timing of that improvement in infectious disease mortality coincides strongly with smallpox mortality in London as a whole, if we just take smallpox as the proportion of all burials in the London bills of mortality, and also the proportion of burials in St Martin's as a whole. Smallpox accounted for about 10% of burials in London across the 18th century until the introduction of vaccination at the very end of the 18th century, and then you get this really marked decline. So smallpox is quite a minor cause of death by the middle of the 19th century, but it's a really major cause of death in cities in the 18th century. If we look at smallpox rates, so we create cause-specific rates in our population by social status group, smallpox mortality shows a similar pattern to infectious disease mortality as a whole. So in the first year of life, smallpox mortality is lower in the higher social status groups than in the poorer social status groups. It appears to rise in these two groups where we have rises in overall mortality. And it falls precipitously with the introduction of vaccination. So Jenner publishes his work in 1796. Coincidence. The possibility is that these higher social status groups are using inoculation before the development of vaccination. So smallpox inoculation was being inoculated with an attenuated form of smallpox that conferred lifelong immunity. There's a really big spread of smallpox inoculation in the late 18th century, but there's also a lot of controversy about whether this was a rural phenomenon and occurred in cities. And there's no evidence in the data for St Martin's that inoculation had much of an impact on smallpox mortality in London. But there's clear evidence in rural populations that it was taken up very enthusiastically, and possibly higher status groups and Quakers also took up inoculation in the late 18th century and experienced precocious falls in infectious disease mortality that the rest of the urban population didn't enjoy until vaccination. So, to conclude, broadly, the data for this large representative parish in London shows quite similar trends to the Quaker sample for London. They both show falls in neonatal mortality that can't be explained, and they both show falls in infectious disease mortality in contrast to the national population as a whole. But the fall occurs earlier amongst the London Quakers and is probably an effect of smallpox inoculation uptake amongst the Quakers that didn't spread amongst the urban population more generally. We saw quite nice exact evidence for class differences in breastfeeding, and this convergence of the wealthy to what the rest of the population did, which is quite nice, because in this period there's a lot of debate about whether the wealthy were leading demographic trends, and I think it's certainly in terms of breastfeeding they were following long established traditions. But this doesn't seem, you get wealthier families showing more maternal breastfeeding, and a fall in neonatal mortality in those families is particularly pronounced, yet it doesn't quite fit as an explanation for why neonatal mortality falls. And that's a bit of a puzzle. It certainly suggests, though, that an argument's been made that the reason that neonatal mortality falls in the general population is improvements in maternal health. And that's unlikely if the higher social status groups enjoy the greatest improvements in neonatal mortality, because these are the groups that we don't expect to be malnourished. So I think this is evidence against maternal nutrition being important in improvements in infant mortality. More work needed. And then it appears that smallpox probably explains the differences in the enormous declines in mortality in urban areas compared with the national population as a whole. Smallpox was much more important in urban areas. It was probably more lethal in high-density populations. And so the introduction of inoculation and then vaccination actually caused improvements in infectious disease mortality in urban populations, whereas in the national population as a whole, the effects of endemicisation were actually to increase infant and child mortality. And they didn't enjoy the benefits of smallpox vaccination to the same extent, because smallpox was never such a major cause of death in the national population. And basically, the urban populations were underrepresented in these national samples. And so actually, it was probably much more important than we see when we use data from smaller rural and small town settlements. Okay, thank you.